My guest today, Gareth Porter, who is getting me a regular on Takes on the World, an independent investigative journalist and historian specializing in U.S. national security policy and institutions. He has been a regular contributor to Interpress News Service, Interpress Service since 2004, and has published long investigative articles in The Nation, Salon, Truth Out, and Raw Story. He's the author of Perils of Dominance, and Balance of Power, and The Road to War in Vietnam. This is his fifth appearance on Takes on the World, and I'm pleased to welcome once again Gareth Porter to Takes on the World.
Good morning, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad you were able to do it. It's interesting times, to say the least. After the first meeting between the P5 plus one countries and Iran collapsed after either the French foreign minister or Iran rejected it, there being two conflicting accounts in the media, John Kerry has been meeting today with senators from both parties, hoping to dissuade them from proposing new sanctions legislation against Iran. And he seems to be taking his cues from Netanyahu and AIPAC, leaving no one watching the administration's back. Everyone in the world knows Congress is beholden to Israel and AIPAC. What's the chances of something positive coming out of this?
Well, the chances are difficult. I don't want to characterize them in terms of 50% or less or more, but it's uncertain to say the least. And, if we're talking about, if we assume for the moment, and this is a big assumption, I think, that the Obama administration is prepared to actually negotiate an agreement that has an end state that says, there will be a removal of all of the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran over the last couple of decades in return for, various stringent controls or limits, I should say, on its nuclear program and, of course, the full panoply of IAEA surveillance and monitoring of its program, then I think the necessity for the president is that he has to say, I will promise to the Iranians that I will exercise all of the national security waivers in the legislation on the sanctions that now exist, and thus essentially make it possible to get around this huge obstacle that Congress, at the behest of Israel, has imposed on the executive branch. That's a very, very tough political gesture or move for the President of the United States to make. I'm not saying that it's impossible. I'm just saying that it's very difficult. And this president has not distinguished himself, in the past at least, in terms of political courage when it comes to this kind of issue. So that makes me relatively pessimistic about the chances of making it through this gauntlet. I guess that's my bottom line.
Well, what we're seeing these days is the whole panoply of Israeli lobbying organizations and media pundits, Foundation for Defense of Democracies, the Foreign Policy Initiative, the replacements for PNAC, Emergency Committee for Israel, Alan Dershowitz, the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution, Elliot Abrams. You have all these columnists and attacking the whole idea of giving Iran anything at this point. And
yes,
then you have Benjamin Netanyahu.
Let's not forget David Frum on CNN, or published by CNN. Yeah.
Oh, I miss David Frum. I was once about to interview him. And then I called him 5 minutes before the broadcast, and he said, "Didn't you get my message? I have a very important lunch today. I can't make it." Anyway, that was some years ago. In any case, you have Netanyahu, who seems to have ready access to American news programs where he can spout his propaganda and get fawning questions from the media. It's an extraordinary situation where a foreign country seems to have such domination over U.S. foreign policy.
It really is. I have noticed myself that in recent days, particularly, I mean, this, of course, is a broader, longer-term phenomenon, but in recent days, particularly around the Geneva talks, Geneva negotiations, that the networks all seem to frame their questions, their interviews with the policymakers, particularly John Kerry, for example, with the point of view of Israel. That is the, it seems, the gold standard by which the news media carries out its coverage of this issue. It is necessary for, it is regarded apparently as necessary for the news media to structure their stories so that the obstacle, the objection of Israel's position is not presented as a problem that one should have some questions about, but that it is legitimate, and therefore it is something that the United States must adjust to. That is the unspoken or unarticulated assumption that underlies the media coverage of this issue.
Well, it also seems that the assumption is made in the media that is that Iran is trying to get a nuclear weapon. Also, and without any proof of that, and also that it has adopted, or the members of Congress have seemed to have adopted Israel's position that all nuclear enrichment by Iran must be stopped. And if that's the bottom line, Iran obviously is not going to accept that.
Yeah, and just let me make the point here, which I know you understand, and I think your listeners probably generally understand it as well, but it bears being very explicit about it, that the very fact that Israel is obviously determined to prevent Iran from having even the most limited capacity for enrichment, and even under the most stringent controls, casts a severe doubt, obvious doubt, on the entire narrative that suggests that Iran was always trying to get nuclear weapons. And this brings me then to, if I could, to make a little comment that I have been working on a book that makes the that essentially debunks the dominant media narrative and the dominant U.S.-Israeli official narrative about the Iranian nuclear program, going back all the way to the 1980s, to the earliest period of the Iranian nuclear program itself. And it simply documents the fact that there has been a systematic disinformation campaign going on for decades about this issue, which has completely screwed up the understanding of most readers of newspapers and watchers of television news for such a long time, that is what has put us into this situation where they could get away with what we're now talking about. So my book is called Manufactured Crisis. It's going to be out in February on Valentine's Day. There'll be more information coming out in the coming weeks and months, but I wanted your listeners to know that that is on its way, and I think many of them will be interested in it.
Well, I certainly will be. I know they will be, and we're going to have you on the air to talk about that for sure. What's interesting is we know that because of a conversation with Richard Nixon, Goldmayer back in 1973, no American president is permitted to mention that Israel has nuclear weapons. But it seems that the whole of American mainstream media is also part of that deal. That you never see the question of Israel's nuclear weapons come up, although actually I do believe that Steve Inskip did do an interview with Netanyahu, and he did bring it up, but not forcefully. Netanyahu ignored it, and Inskip did not follow through on it. But that was the first time I had heard any mainstream news anchor, news reporter, and NPR is mainstream for the intellectual class.
I do believe you're correct, and I think that that's another indicator of just how complete the blanket of silence about the Israeli position in all of this and the role that Israel's played in all of this has been. I mean, as my book is going to document, I mean, Israel has been behind all of the major claims, all the major allegations about a secret Iranian nuclear weapons program from the beginning. They are the sources of all this, and there has been a conspiracy of silence in the IAEA to cover that up. Once El-Baradei left, now El-Baradei in his memoirs actually says explicitly that Israel was the source of these documents that they have been using to make the claims about Iran. Once El-Baradei left the IAEA, his successor has played along with this, and the Safeguards Department of the IAEA has certainly played that game of hiding the fact that all of the documentation that is the basis for their allegations about Iran came from Israel.
As apparently did the chemical weapons allegations against Syria.
Well, certainly the Israelis, as I recall, were the first to have made that publicly claimed that the Syrians used chemical weapons going back to, I think it was May, that the Israeli military intelligence guy gave a briefing, and that was then that brought pressure on the Europeans, who immediately responded by publicly declaring, I think it was the French first and then the UK, declaring that Syria had indeed used chemical weapons. And the Obama administration then followed, I think reluctantly, but ultimately knuckled under in June to that line.
Well, it seems that at the current time, U.S. Middle East policy is in almost like a free fall. We have the situation where the not improbable alliance between Israel and the Saudis, and the most obvious break in U.S.-Saudi relations in my memory, in which the Saudi officials publicly excoriate the Obama administration and now have actually reached out to France and are going to make some arms purchases from the French. And the U.S. has, of course, relied on Saudis' arms purchases to keep its arms industry afloat for years. How do you look at this situation?
Well, first of all, I do agree that the arms purchases that the United States has arranged with the Saudis have been extremely important to the arms industry. And in writing my book, at one point I was going to include an analysis, of the importance of that market for U.S. arms, not just the Saudis, but the UAE as well, in particular, to the U.S. arms industry, and the role that's played in the Department of Defense's position on Iran, which, of course, has been a key factor in the past in U.S. policy. That is to say, the Department of Defense has wanted Iran to be an adversary, to be regarded as a dangerous enemy, because it was a justification for some very important transactions that the military and their friends in the arms industry had underway or were planning. And I estimated, by the way, that the value of the arms sales to the Saudis and other Gulf sheikhdoms over the coming decade or more would be in the neighborhood of $200 billion. So, I mean, this is a huge fortune for the arms industry, and, you know, the military undoubtedly really cared about that very much. That is, I think, a very important factor in U.S. policy. Now, whether that was the primary factor that influenced the French in this instance of the turnaround by Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius in Geneva is another question. I'm not convinced of that. I think that in this case we know that there was a phone call from the close friend of Netanyahu in Paris, Meir Habib, who is a member of the National Assembly, but is also known to be Netanyahu's, basically his main representative in Paris. And he called the prime minister and the foreign minister and warned them that if the French did not oppose this adequately, if it did not oppose the draft agreement, and if the six powers signed the agreement with Iran, that then Netanyahu would attack the nuclear facilities in Iran. So, I mean, this is a very, very dramatic indication that the Israelis were quite desperate, that they needed to do something that would have a dramatic effect on French policy. So that convinces me that the French were not already lined up to do this, and that this came about as a result of a last-minute appeal and threat from Tel Aviv, or from Jerusalem, I should say.
Well, one of the things that has been said by former Israeli general, that should there be an agreement, even any kind of agreement with Iran, it would preclude Israel from then attacking Iran while negotiations and a deal was going on. And so even though there's speculation, people said, well, Israel would never attack Iran on its own, but we do know that there is legislation. Lindsey Graham has promised it, that would authorize the U.S. to come to Israel's aid should Israel feel obligated to defend itself against a non-existent Iranian nuclear program. So there is a good reason, obviously, for the Israelis to oppose any kind of agreement with Iran, because it threatens what they can do.
Well, you know, I want to make a couple points about that. One is that I have been saying for most of the past year, I think since last March, that the Israelis' threat to, the Netanyahu threat to attack Iran is really part of a much longer-term ruse, which is aimed at manipulating U.S. policy, European policy, and policy of other members of the six powers. It's been very effective in that regard. It has been an instrument by which the Israelis could sort of push the United States and other countries into much deeper into the sanctions. For example, I think the Obama administration had not really wanted to sign on to sanctions that would cut so deeply into the crude oil market. But I think the Israelis effectively pressured them into doing that. It was not simply the threat of an attack. I think it was other kinds of pressures. But what I'm saying is that I think the Israeli intention all along has been simply to use that threat as a diplomatic maneuver, a source of leverage. I don't think that Netanyahu ever has had any intention of attacking Iran. I was in Israel early summer, and what I learned was that the Israeli military and intelligence people have been mainly going along with the threat to attack Iran because they felt that this was indeed a way that Netanyahu could effectively leverage the policies of, move the policies of the rest of the world in the direction that Israel wanted them. But they never, you know, would support an attack on Iran. And in fact, there was an incident in 2010 when the Israelis thought there was going to be a deal made on a fuel swap. And at that point, Netanyahu tried to order the military, the Israeli military, the IDF, to call the highest level of alert, which is, in effect, a prelude to war. And he clearly was doing so with the intention of trying to alarm the United States and others and get them to change their mind. And this was revealed only a couple of years later. But it illustrates the way in which this ruse has been used by the Israelis. It was also used in 2008. There was a war scare then that many of your listeners will remember. Even I was convinced that the Israelis intended to attack Iran at that point. And I've learned in doing my book that, in fact, they had no intention of doing that. It was simply, it was a way of trying to raise the pressure on the rest of the world to convince them that there was a danger of Israeli attack if they didn't take action against Iran. So I wanted to make that point. And then the other thing, let's see, I'm trying to remember the second point that you were making. I took too long for that. I apologize.
Well, no, I was actually, I agree with you. Actually, it goes back to Moshe Dayan in 73, threatening to use nuclear weapons against Egypt if the United States didn't come through with a huge supply of weaponry.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then it goes to exactly to the situation now with regard to Iraq. And, I mean, they're threatening that, oh, you know, if they don't put a stop to Iraq, then we'd have to bomb it.
You mean Iran?
ARAK, that is the IR-40 heavy water
reactor. Oh, right, okay, yes.
In Iran, That is a source of confusion, I'm
right.
sure. And I should have spelled it out.
Yeah.
But that's what they're threatening to bomb, and that makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, it's well known to the Israelis, I'm quite sure, that that Iranians have already stated in the early phase of the talks in October that they were prepared to have all of the spent fuel that would be produced by the Arak reactor, heavy water plutonium reactor, taken away, so that there was no possibility that it could be reprocessed for a nuclear weapon. And, you know, the Iranians have no ability, no capability now to reprocess. It requires a reprocessing plant, which is quite a large operation. It can't be hidden. So this is all just crap. I mean, you know, it is just propaganda. It is nothing more than pressure tactic.
How much does Israel's antipathy toward Hezbollah figure into this?
Well, I mean, I suppose the fear and loathing of Hezbollah figures into their Syria policy quite directly, of course. That's why they are carrying out strikes in Syria. They've carried out three or four strikes since the beginning of the year in Syria. And I suppose that it figures in to the extent that that Hezbollah is part of the Iranian deterrent, right? I mean, since at least for the last 10 years or so, the Iranians have viewed the rockets that they've sent to Hezbollah as a key part of their deterrent against Israeli attack. But I think that is changing. I think the role of Hezbollah as a deterrent for Iran is much less than it would have been a few years ago primarily because of the advances that the Iranian missile program has made. When I was in Israel, I interviewed the father of the anti-missile system of Israel, who told me that the accuracy of Iranian missiles has improved dramatically over recent years, is continuing to improve, and he told me that he asked his military friends, how do you feel about trying to carry out a war with Iran with the electricity gone? Because he believes the Iranians will very soon be able to target very specifically the infrastructure, including the whole electricity grid of Israel, in any war. If they're attacked, they'll be able to retaliate against both economic and civilian targets, so military and civilian targets. So that is the situation that I think the Israelis face. Another reason why I think they have no intention of actually attacking Iran, but are, you know, using that as a very effective tool, particularly with the support of the news media, which have talked that up incessantly for the last couple of years.
I'm speaking with Gareth Porter. One interesting thing most Americans are not aware of is the extent to which sanctions on Iran are sanctions against all the other countries around the world, that many of whom have relied on Iranian oil and have gotten waivers up to this point. in terms of being able to buy oil. But Senator Menendez, the loyal Democrat from New Jersey via Cuba, has said that that these countries like China, Japan, South Korea, Turkey, and so on, are going to have to slash their purchases from Iran even further. So, in fact, what the United States is doing as an imperial power is, in fact, dictating to the economies of the world, including our allies, what they can and cannot do. This is an extraordinary thing, and most Americans are not aware of it. It's not even discussed in anywhere in the mainstream media.
I agree completely. This is an outrageous policy for the United States to pursue, and one that is quite extraordinary. There's never been anything like it in history. And I know everyone will recall that after 1973, the Arabs threatened to boycott the United States, threatened not to sell oil to the United States, and this was regarded as a, or at least regarded by some hawks, as a potential casus belli with the United States using military force to prevent them from, withholding oil from the market. So here we have the United States taking actions which, deliberately manipulate, deliberately prevent one country from being able to export oil to another country, and as you correctly put it, then also preventing those countries from being able to get the oil that they want from the country they want to buy it from. And I have to say that I do believe the United States has sown a great deal of bad feelings on the part of a number of countries that have been the object of this policy, the subject of this policy, I should say. They have adjusted their policy under pressure from the United States simply because the legislation mandates that the United States will cut off other forms of economic interaction with these countries if they do not comply. And the U.S. market is too important to these countries to simply to thumb their nose at the United States. But there's no question that this has caused a great deal of hard feeling toward the United States. And I think from that point of view, it is in the future, it's going to come back to bite us. It's not going to be something, it's going to have blowback effects. It's not going to be something that we will regard years from now as having been anything but a disaster.
Well, you mentioned casus belli. Obviously, Iran would have more than enough reason to attack the United States. The United States is, in fact, waging war on Iran economically.
Yes, it is a form of economic warfare. That's correct.
It would be interesting if they went to the United Nations, to the court, and declared it as such, and actually get some kind of discussion, because there isn't any kind of discussion about this in the mainstream media, or even, as far as I'm concerned, within the alternative media.
Well, I think you're right. It's something that needs to be highlighted. There needs to be more work done to clarify the significance of this. And I would not rule out the possibility that the Iranians will, in fact, raise that in the future, particularly if these negotiations fail. I think we have to expect the Iranians are going to take a number of dramatic moves, both diplomatic and political, as well as potentially military, at least to threaten again to disrupt the oil traffic through the narrow Strait of Hormuz.
Hello, you are on Takes on the World.
Good morning. Good morning, Gareth.
Good morning.
I always enjoy your articles.
Thank you.
I think it's critical to point out that while all of this Sturm und Drang is taking place about the nuclear negotiations, Israel continues to steal, usurp, and colonize West Bank territory, and the so-called peace negotiations apparently are not only dead in the water, but are sinking to the bottom of the ocean. Can we strip away all of this existential threat nonsense and sort of look at the fact that it's not that Iran or Syria or their proxies are a threat to Israel's existence? They're in the way. They're in the way of the eventual takeover of the entire West Bank and either the expulsion or the absorption of the Palestinians into some sort of a apartheid state. So I'd like your comments on that.
Yeah,
Thank you. Not only
do I agree with that comment, but I simply want to point out that in my book, I'm going to document the fact that the lie now being told by Netanyahu that that he and the Likud party regard Iran as an existential threat to Israel goes all the way back to the Labor government of 1992.
Rabin
government in 1992, making that same argument, but it was an instrumental argument. It was never really believed. It was never truly believed. They knew that Iran did not represent an existential threat in any way, shape, or form. So without going into more detail, I mean, I do have a lot of documentation on the historical background of just how Israel has manipulated that idea from as long ago as 1992, precisely for the purpose of setting up a situation where the United States and the international community would weaken Iran either through military attack or economic sanctions, and thus remove, as I think the caller correctly put it, an obstacle to Israel's having its way, both with regard to the West Bank and, I must say, throughout the Middle East in general. I mean, you know, the Israelis also want to eliminate Iran as a regional power because they simply demand hegemony in the Middle East. They want to have military hegemony in the Middle East, and they simply cannot abide having another power which could in any way block or prevent the Israelis from using force as freely as they wish.
Well, that's actually what I was going to say. They put Iran up there because a denuclearized, or let's say a Iran sanctioned to the ground, eliminates any other possible obstacle to Israel's maintaining hegemony of the Middle East.
Exactly, exactly. And that has been the objective all along from the beginning.
In Lebanon, last time I was there, which was actually 6 years ago, I spoke to Michel Aoun, who is a former general and president and the head of the largest Maronite Christian party, and he said his support for Hezbollah is based on practical reasons. Were it not for Hezbollah, Israel would have its way in Lebanon.
Well, that's exactly right. No question about it. I mean, it was Hezbollah which prevented the Israelis from basically consolidating their grip on Lebanon, which certainly they would have loved to have been able to have maintained.
Also, I should point out that one thing that is never printed in the American media is the fact that the largest Christian party, the majority of the Christian population in Lebanon, is allied with Hezbollah, and the alliance won the last election when they had one, 55%, and you never see that reference because it would destroy the illusion that Hezbollah is simply a Shia version of Al-Qaeda.
Well, and when I was in Lebanon a couple of years ago, I heard the same thing, of course, from a political advisor to the head of the Sunni bloc in Lebanon. He was quite honest about saying that that there was indeed a non-Shia Christian element that was supporting Hezbollah's position, and basically was a key to the political balance in the country.
Now, the situation, of course, we haven't mentioned situation in Syria. We're just running out of time, but how do you see the Hezbollah situation has changed because of the involvement on behalf of the Bashar al-Assad regime?
Well, are you asking whether its involvement in Syria has made a difference within Lebanon?
Yes, that's what I was talking about.
I have not followed that closely, but I'm not aware that has really changed the situation at all in Lebanon. I don't think that's the case. Of course, the Sunnis are using that. They feel very strongly about the whole Sunni Shia, the Shia crescent threat, and there may be an effect on the Sunnis themselves. That is to say, it has mobilized them. I think I would agree with that. But I don't think it has changed the fundamental balance politically and militarily within Lebanon.
I do know that early in the Syrian the protests began, that friends in Beirut, the Maronite Christian community, told me that the price for Kalashnikovs jumped up to 2,000, and some of the Sunnis from Lebanon went in to fight in Syria.
Well, I can tell you that the biggest impact of what's happening in Syria on Lebanon has been, of course, the exodus of a very, very large number of Syrian refugees into Lebanon, and two effects. One, you know, electricity blackouts are now common because of the use of electricity by the Syrians, and real estate is being bought up by wealthy Syrians and forcing the price of real estate up tremendously.
A lot of problems and no solutions on the horizon. Gareth Porter, I want to thank you for being our guest again today in Takes of the World. I'm looking forward to speaking with you again when your next book comes out, and maybe before that.
Thanks so much, Jeff. I appreciate it.
We appreciate it here for sharing your opinions and thoughts and your expertise. Take care.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.